This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, inmates at prisons across the nation will go on strike in August against slavery behind the bars. The Democratic Party sides with CIA spies and the FBI in its suit against WikiLeaks. And Winnie Mandela is remembered as a voice against compromise with white corporate power in South Africa.
But first, in a unanimous vote, the Michigan Supreme Court last week exonerated and set free Reverend Edward Pinckney, the Benton Harbor, Michigan activist who spent 2.5 years in prison for allegedly tampering with signatures on an election recall petition. At his trial before an all-white jury, Reverend Pinckney had argued that the charge was baseless, but it took 30 months in prison for him to get the state Supreme Court to agree with him. Nevertheless, he's a happy man.
I was so excited. Matter of fact, I haven't been able to sleep for a couple of days because it's more like a major victory for the people. You see, because nobody ever go into Barron County and win. We have attorneys who've been practicing 20 years, never had a victory. And there's several. It's not just one or two. Nobody ever defeats these people because they're connected all the way to the top.
But you have defeated them twice, although at a heavy price to yourself.
Absolutely. You see, I can look past the time served because it gives the people in the community hope. You see, we are one hopeless, really, community because we haven't learned how to come together. My message to them is more of us than them. And if we ever decided that we were going to put aside our difference and come out and fight, we can win. And this is a perfect example. And like last night on the news, they interviewed me, and it was a good one. You know, they normally chop me up, make me the villain, but this time they couldn't do it. And my final words was, it's going down. And that's what people hear this morning while I was driving out. The last words they said, you told them on TV it was going down. I said, yes, I did. But it's important. See, here's what we're missing about this. We allow these people to beat us down. And then we go run and put our heads in a hole and think it's all right. It's not all right. It's time that we took a stand and showed these people that we're going to stand up for what's right. I knew what they was doing. Matter of fact, at the trial, I went out and did the research. And I told them that this was a penalty. Matter of fact, I wrote the motion to have the charges dismissed because it was a penalty and not a crime. Because actually there's no such charge as forgery on a recall petition. You can have a misstatement. They call it a misstatement, which is a misdemeanor charge. But they had to charge Reverend Pinckney with a felony and 5 of them in order to accomplish their goal. They knew that if they had an all-white jury, and most of the time we have an all-white jury here in Benton Harbor, that Pinckney would be convicted. That jury was motivated by something other than the truth.
And yet the Supreme Court of Michigan voted 6-0 on your side, saying that no such charge existed, and you weren't even convicted of a misdemeanor.
That's correct. See, it's so important because even in a court of appeals, the biggest issue was there was absolutely no evidence that could have convicted me. That was the major issue, but they couldn't give me that one. And here's the reason why. It would have shown racism inside the court system, which they don't want people to acknowledge. You see, these people, they didn't have not one single witness to come in and say Reverend Pinckney did anything. They have nobody. They had this spectacle of Pinckney recalls everybody. So what? That's my job to recall you Somebody got to hold you people accountable for your action and your inaction. That's my job. And I tell you, Glenn Boyd, this is big because now people all over the country is calling. I got calls from California. There's an article in USA Today. All these people, they want to know, and they all want to talk. I was on the phone so much yesterday that I'd be so wound up that I can't sleep at night. But I'm enjoying it, and I'm going to enjoy this victory. I'm going to continue to fight for what's right.
Well, in fact, you're going to continue this recall that was the original reason for you being thrown in prison.
Oh, absolutely. You see, one of the things about the recall that's so important that people don't realize, it put fear in people here. When Pinckney said he's going to recall somebody, everybody starts shaking in their boots around here, especially the elected officials, because they don't know who I'm going to target. And don't make no difference whether you're black or white to me. If you're not doing the right thing, you're going down. It's just that simple.
Well, have you chosen the next target? You've had a lot of time to think about it.
Not as of yet. So much is happening right now. We're trying to concentrate on our next step. We want to charge the prosecutor with misconduct. And we want to sit there with the judge, also charge him. And we're putting together a letter to be sent to the judicial commission to take a look at this case and find out how did it happen. See, that's the most important thing. We as black people, we usually don't have the resources to fight back. But I just thank God that I had the resources to fight back and win. It's not a Pinckney victory. This is a victory for the people. Everybody that is connected in this world, black people, even white people, it's a victory for them too. But it just shows what we can do when we learn to stand together, fight together, and stop talking about who we can't work with, who we don't like, because that's how they divide us up and conquer us. But I'm excited. I am so excited. I've been riding through the neighborhood all day this morning, and people been coming out their houses, want to wave, want to talk. Everybody want to talk now. But I'm satisfied. But I want to show them that we can win.
In fact, you ran into the judge who put you behind bars just the other day.
Yes, I did. Matter of fact, I went over to do my regular court watching. And as I was over there, I ran into the chief judge. And he was laughing, and we was just laughing. It's not a funny matter, a joking matter, but he was saying, what we going to do to keep you under control? I said, you got to improve your justice system. And as we was talking, the judge that sentenced me came up, and I reached out my hand to shake his hand. I tried to break his hand. I was squeezing his hand so hard, and his face was turning so red. He couldn't say nothing because the chief judge was there. And he just looked at me. He froze. He just stood there. He couldn't move because he knew what he did was wrong. Now he know I know it was wrong, and the chief judge knows it's wrong. So his days is number two. So I can do some things over there. I can work with a few people, but it's so important that people understand I'm not going to let them stop me. I'm not going to let them hold me back. I'm going to continue doing what I've been doing for years, and they're not going to intimidate me or make me afraid of their action.
Which raises the question, despite this 6-0 decision by the Supreme Court, what is there to stop the same forces that brought that charge and got an all-white jury to convict you and got the appeals court to turn you down until finally it went to the Supreme Court? What's to stop them from starting that process all over again?
We got to start attacking them. We got to charge them. When they commit a crime or a violation, we got to start charging them. We got to see too many times we're so intimidated by them. Oh, one of the things my lawyer said, oh, you're going to make them mad. I'm already mad. So what difference do that make whether I make you mad or not? I'm already angry. I'm already upset. My thing is that we have to start attacking them, put them on the defense. Until we put them on the defense, it's going to continue just like this. See, one of the things, the weapons that they use, they got us so divided up. Black people do things for money. They'll do anything to drive a nice car. They'll do anything to live in a nice house. They'll do anything to have money all in their pockets rather than stand up for what's right for the community and the people. We got to change the way we do business. We can no longer sit around here and listen to these preachers in our community. That is one of the groups that's holding the black people back. And they're going to continue holding us back because we won't hold a minister accountable for his action and inaction. We don't do that. We won't do that. We think, well, you don't talk about God, anointed man, and all this kind of stuff. This is how we talk. And it's unfortunate. This is why we're in this position we're in today. And it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse before it get better.
And you, of course, although you were former head of the NAACP in Benton Harbor, you've had no support from the traditional black leadership.
Oh, absolutely not. Matter of fact, they had a meeting about me. All the preachers, these are the NAACP, and all the rest of them, they talked about how much they hated Reverend Pinckney. We hate Reverend Pinckney. And one guy got up and said, he hates me more than anything else. And the guy said, I hate him more than you. Then got up on Sunday and preached the gospel. So you tell me where we at and what we need to do, because I tell you, I'm not holding back about these preachers. I'm going to make them do. If they say they're men of God and women of God, they're going to stand up for what God stands for, or else they're going to hear from me also.
So where's it going, Reverend?
It's going down. We're going to come together and win this battle. We're going to win this war. We're going to win it because it's going down.
That was Reverend Edward Pinckney at his home in Benton Harbor, Michigan.
The Democratic National Committee last month brought a multi-million dollar lawsuit against WikiLeaks, the Russian government, and the Trump administration, blaming all three for Hillary Clinton's defeat in the 2016 election. The suit against WikiLeaks is especially disturbing because it could cripple the ability of journalists to report on government wrongdoing in the United States. In Washington, we spoke with Chip Gibbons of Defending Rights and Dissent.
The WikiLeaks lawsuit that the DNC is bringing in is extremely disturbing. Whether or not you like WikiLeaks or you dislike them, it's hard to imagine any sort of situation in which the DNC can successfully sue WikiLeaks for publishing documents that were given to them that were newsworthy for economic espionage and that not reverberate across other press groups. So if the DNC can sue WikiLeaks, why can't they sue the New York Times or The Intercept for reporting on the same documents? Or why can't they sue any of the news outlets that have gotten Trump's tax returns and reported on them? It's a very dangerous precedent to say that a news entity is liable for publishing newsworthy information because a third party got it through nefarious means. Of course, if you hack into someone's computer and break into their house, I mean, you're not immune from prosecution because you're a media entity, but if someone else does that and they give it to the news organization, they report on it, I mean, that's just basic journalism. And this lawsuit, I mean, they're really capitalizing on the fear-mongering about Russia and Russiagate, and they're capitalizing on a number of people are, you know, don't like WikiLeaks for whatever reason. And they're using that to try to bring it through this lawsuit that will have really detrimental impacts to press freedom and to the First Amendment.
Now, in my memory, this is, of course, not the first time that individual Democratic politicians or caucuses of Democratic or Republican politicians have taken actions detrimental to the First Amendment, but this is the Democratic Party taking this position.
Yeah, so both Republican and Democratic parties are not tremendous friends of our right to dissent or any of our First Amendment freedoms. I mean, Democratic and Republican politicians alike have proposed and enacted, you know, terrible legislation, terrible policies that have really gone after press freedom. But for the Democratic National Committee as a party to bring in this lawsuit is a new low even for them, which is hard to imagine. But every time you think they can't go any lower, they always manage to unpleasantly surprise you. That is the great thing about our ruling class.
But it does seem to be in line with the political alliance that has existed for the last couple of years and is quite apparent between the DNC and the FBI and even the CIA. This alliance has become quite visible in the context of Russiagate.
Sure. So the Democrats have sort of tried to couch themselves as more loyal to the security state than the Republicans. They've tried to couch themselves as more willing to wage aggressive war, more willing to wage unconstitutional surveillance practices. So instead of attacking Trump for being a white supremacist, you know, and a puppet of the 1% who are enacting these policies that hurt working people, hurt people of color, policies that are unleashing the U.S. military across the Middle East and escalating civilian casualties. He's killed more people with drone strikes in his first year in office than Obama did through all eight. He's killed a record number of civilians in Afghanistan. Instead of attacking those policies, they're trying to say that Trump is somehow disloyal and not aggressive and bellicose and not into the security state enough. So they're trying to like out-militarize, out-anti-civil libertarianize Donald Trump. And part of that is they keep parroting this narrative that Trump is a puppet of Russia, that the Republicans are disloyal to this threat, and we have to once again save democracy by destroying it at home. And it's an extremely dangerous narrative. I mean, if you look at the McClatchy press report yesterday, where they had this horrifying article accusing pipeline protesters of being promoted by Russia, the headline is something like, oh, now that there's no longer a 2016 election, Russian trolls are promoting anti-pipeline protests. Or you see that again and again, where there's this fixation that Russian trolls are supporting Black Lives Matter, because Black people in this country need the Russians to tell them that they're faced with police violence and state repression. And you see this really just horrifying McCarthyite atmosphere around Dr. Jill Stein, who was asked to comply with a request by the Senate Intelligence Committee. And I, at Defending Rights to Dissent, wrote a letter to the Intelligence Committee telling that their request was chilling to free. She complied with most of it, overwhelming part of the request. And you see this constant media hounding, you know, what is she hiding? You see senior reporters saying, oh, she's using Russian talking points, as though having the wrong foreign policy view or not being deferential enough to the Senate Intelligence Committee is evidence that you're a foreign agent. I mean, it's just a horrendous atmosphere for dissent right now from both the Democrats who are, you know, ratcheting up the Russiagate stuff and from the Republicans who are, you know, rallying around an authoritarian white supremacist. So you're getting it from both sides.
And of course, if we're talking about enemies of political dissent, we must speak of the FBI. Your organization, Defending Rights and Dissent, is sounding the alarm. It has been sounding the alarm about the FBI's use of informants as political tools.
Sure. So the FBI has more confidential informants now than they had during COINTELPRO. These informants, oftentimes in recent years, go around and sort of manipulate people into participating in false terrorist plots. So you'll find informants just wandering around to the Muslim community, approaching strangers and being like, hey, do you want to participate in this entirely fictional terrorist plot? And they'll prey on people who are very vulnerable. They'll offer them cash or money. In one case, somebody said no to the FBI informant a number of times until their brother was diagnosed with, I believe it was cancer, and they did money for medical treatment. And they said, hey, do you still have that money for me to do this terrorist act that doesn't exist? And the FBI goes in and arrests them. And, you know, this bolsters Donald Trump, because in his Muslim ban executive order, he cites two quote-unquote terror plots created by refugees, but both of them are plots that existed only in the minds of FBI confidential informants. So you have someone like Comey going around on this, oh, I'm so opposed to Trump tour, but, you know, the FBI, through their just systematic Islamophobia and systematic racism, helped to normalize a lot of the discourse that Trump engaged in and got elected on.
Those of us who are old enough remember when Communist Party chapters, some of them were majority populated by informers. And we learned, those of us who were in the Panther Party, that Fred Hampton's bodyguard was the one who gave the layout to his apartment to guide the police in their assassination against him. But we were told those days were over, but they're not, quite clearly.
They never ended. They never ended. I mean, the Church Committee ends in like 1977. Starting in the early 80s, the FBI is investigating Central American Solidarity activists. They're employing undercover informants. They possibly engage in illegal break-ins. Those days never, ever ended. And I think it's very clear that from the FBI's inception until the present, they've always been the political police force in this country.
And the FBI's use of informants had led to a situation in which it appears the majority of the so-called terror cases domestically that they claim credit for breaking up were probably invented by the informers themselves.
They are invented by the informers themselves, and there's a really sort of insidious impact. Not only do they then ensnare an individual who would never have been prosecuted or had done anything wrong in their life if not for the informant, the FBI then turns around and says, look at these terrorist threats. Look at these Muslims who are committing all of these terrorist acts, and we need more resources. We were going to ratchet up Islamophobia. We were going to further erode civil liberties. So it's this sort of self-perpetuating cycle of state repression that they're engaged in. They make up a plot. They entrap someone. They use cultural institutional Islamophobia to justify what they're doing, and then they encourage more Islamophobia, and they encourage more powers for the FBI.
When we learned that the FBI had a new category called Black Identity Extremists, many of us wondered what that was, but I suppose it's the job of the informant to manufacture the definition.
Well, I actually have a really interesting story about Black Identity Extremists. My colleague at Defending Rights in a Sense, Sue Udry, she attended a meeting of the DC Bias, Hate and Bias Task Force, where they had a presentation on violent extremists that was provided to them by the National Center for Counterterrorism. And there was an entire section on this PowerPoint about Black identity extremists. And we've been trying to obtain this PowerPoint because we want to know how many other communities are giving it. But this is literally a community meeting in Ward 1, Washington, D.C., of the quote-unquote hate and bias task force, which is supposed to be, you know, countering hate and bias. And they're giving a PowerPoint to community members about how Black identity extremists are a terrorist threat. And it's really shocking.
So we see that in practice, they are turning hate extremist on its head, going after the folks who are opposed to the extremist and hate policies that are endemic to the United States.
Absolutely. And that's what they've always done. J. Edgar Hoover's FBI labeled Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference a black hate group. So the FBI has always interpreted hate group to mean African Americans advocating for racial justice, not what the FBI does and attacking African Americans, which is an actual hate group.
And of course, hating the police is an extremist.
Yes, yes.
Category.
And, you know, a number of states are trying to amend their hate crime statutes to include police as a protected class. So being mean to police is exactly like committing a hate crime because of somebody's sexual orientation or racial identity or national origin. It's really insulting, actually, when you think about the fact that hate crime statutes exist to protect people who have been marginalized, people our government has refused to protect, and they are now using them to protect one of the most overprotected class of people there are, that's law enforcement.
Yes, one could make the case that the most protected class in the United States is the police.
They certainly get away with a lot of stuff you and I wouldn't get away with. They have a number of legal protections through their, you know, police unions, putting into law all kinds of things. I remember, I think it was when the police officer murdered Michael Brown, he didn't have to be interrogated for 2 days or something like that. I mean, imagine if you or I were accused of a murder, they wouldn't wait several days to ask us questions. They'd do it right away.
One point of unity that ought to connect everybody that considers themselves progressive is the First Amendment and the right to dissent. But I think we see erosions on that count, movement-wise as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unfortunate that with Trump in office, huge parts of the liberal left have sort of devoted themselves to defending the FBI, defending Comey, defending the CIA, and defending all of these very insidious groups that are just as authoritarian and just as problematic as Trump. And if you want to be on the left, we do need to tackle the fact that we have a political police force in this country called the FBI, not going around and touting Comey, somebody who lied about there being an uptick in crime so he could blame Black Lives Matter for it, as a progressive hero, because he's not.
That was Chip Gibbons of Defending Rights and Dissent in Washington.
The South African Liberation Movement lost one of its most militant advocates, with the death of Winnie Mandela last month. The former wife of Nelson Mandela was a leading figure in the more radical wing of the African National Congress, the party that came to power with the end of apartheid, but now rules in close collaboration with white corporate forces. Black Agenda Report editor and columnist Marsha Coleman Adebayo hosts a radio program titled What's at Stake on Pacifica Radio, WPFW, in Washington, D.C. Coleman Adebayo took an in-depth look at Winnie Mandela's life and struggle, which was sometimes at odds with her former husband and his political allies.
For most Americans, once Nelson Mandela became president of South Africa on May 10, 1994, after liberation forces defeated the brutal and repressive apartheid regime, their attention was diverted to other issues. Yet it was after Mandela was released from prison and inaugurated as president that the struggle for political and economic power became exceptionally fierce. Political tendencies simmering during the liberation struggle became front and center. One faction supporting neoliberal pro-West policies and another supporting populist pro-socialist ideas contained in the Freedom Charter. Winnie Mandela was front and center in this debate. She became the target for her populist and unwavering support of the ideas contained in the Freedom Charter. As such, the mark was on her back. It was clear that for the myth of the Rainbow Nation to succeed, she would have to be destroyed. In order to help us deconstruct and understand the powerhouse that was Winnie Mandela, we are joined by Dr. P. Wakula Onyango, Department of African Studies and Department of World Languages and Culture, Howard University, Benjamin Woods, a co-founder of Students Against Mass Incarceration. Ben received his master's degree in Africana Studies from Cornell University. He's committed to Pan-Africanism and a socialist transformation. Sandra Ratley has over 40 years' experience as a media and information leader. She's currently executive producer for TV and video for the Futuro Media Group. Sandra was press spokesman for Nelson Mandela's first national U.S. tour and served as media representative and speechwriter for Winnie Mandela. Well, let's start from the beginning. There's a great deal of controversy raging in South Africa in the aftermath of Winnie Mandela's death, primarily due to an independent film by a French filmmaker, and the film is called Winnie. Many South Africans are just learning about the propaganda campaign that was waged against her character and the false allegations of murder and criminal activities that she suffered during her lifetime. These accusations were all aimed at destroying Miss Mandela. Professor, let's start with you. What was it in Winnie Mandela's background that allowed her to survive such vicious attacks?
Well, I would say in true African tradition, Mama Winnie Mandela's parents seem to have been very inspired when they gave her the name Nomzamo. Nomzamo is a Xhosa name, which means no lady, Mzamo, effort. So lady of effort or lady of endeavors. It seemed like they knew that their daughter, who would go on to become the first social worker to work in Johannesburg, the first social worker who's a woman and African, highly qualified, who would go on to win a scholarship to come to America and study, who would have to make a choice. Do I go to America and study and work for myself, or do I stay here and work for my people? And of course, we know what decision she made. So her name alone speaks to a very prophetic vision that her parents seem to have held about her. That is perhaps the first point of departure about who this woman was. I'm going to start right there.
Okay, thank you. Sandra, would you like to help us with this question?
I appreciate what Dr. Myandu just said. Nanzamo, actually, as he said, she who must endure trials. I think that personal experience I had kind of witnessing Winnie in context in South Africa, I would say that she really, really was fearless. Shireen Hassim, who's a political science professor in South Africa and author of a book that says Women Organizations and Democracy in South Africa Contesting Authority, she states of Mama Winnie, no other woman in life and after occupies the place that Winnie Madikizela Mandela does in South African politics. I do believe that one of the main issues that is not talked about in the context of Winnie's life and her accomplishments, the very fact that she is a woman, in some ways really conscribed and constricted her impact, even though she is someone who had massive impact in the diaspora and the world as well as South Africa, that the very fact that she was a woman made it, I think, much more difficult for her. When you consider that, of course, there were women's organizations, the Federation of South African Women, the ANC Women's League, but in the when you look at the history of South Africa and the people who were high-profile people who made many sacrifices, whether it's Chris Hani, Steve Biko, and Nelson Mandela, there is no woman who occupies the same space. So it's, I think, in talking about her, we have to talk about her as a woman playing the historic role that she did in South Africa. And as you mentioned, being active with Umkhonto we Sizwe, going on raids, and actually wanting to see the physical destruction of apartheid, also constantly working for the disenfranchised and working to make it clear about the wealth disparities in the country and to try to rectify the historical imbalance in terms of the economy of South Africa. I think that those things really do highlight who she was and why she did attract so much controversy and negativity.
Thank you. Ben?
Yeah, I think Winnie Mandela represents someone who was fearless and uncompromising in her views. When so much of the ANC was forced underground, she was one of the few people who would walk the streets, wear her colors, speak and say things that no one else or very few people would openly publicly state in terms of representing the ANC in an uncompromising position. And for that, she gained the love of the people, and people will still call her the mother of the nation. Like, it's something to see the documentary that you discussed. I had seen it a couple times, and just before coming on here, I watched it again, and it's amazing to see her walking in front of these young people, because it was the young people who really supported her. And that uncompromising position, and like she mentioned, her being a woman, and especially for even more so, that uncompromising position when other people in the ANC wanted to do a negotiated settlement, so-called negotiated settlement, having a series of meetings in the 1980s, whether it was Nelson Mandela being released from Robben's Island, and having meetings in a nice, comfortable house and so forth. Meanwhile, and the leadership of the ANC is negotiating the economy and the land, a way to stay and maintain the hand of the white settlers. It was Winnie Mandela, forces like her, that represented the left wing of the ANC, the most radical sectors, and Chris Hani, people like them who was assassinated, who was unwilling to accept huge IMF deals in the early 1990s, who wouldn't accept the 1996 class project, as it's called. So Winnie Mandela is just a major force and an inspiration to people throughout South Africa, throughout Africa, and I think the diaspora in the world.
Yeah, you know, from my perspective too, I just totally agree with the analysis here. I think one of the major problems that we have all faced is having the kind of propaganda instrument on the left so that we're able to get our message out. And so one of the problems I think that Winnie faced in 1994 and before 1994 was, how do they get their message out? Because the West was in full swing with the Rainbow Nation. They were in full swing with this neoliberal approach to economic development in South Africa. And that provided the avenue for them to basically demonize Winnie Mandela as being peripheral to the entire process in South Africa, holding Nelson Mandela down from his almost angelic role of ushering in the new the new South Africa. And so even if you look at the film Mandela by Idris Elba, right? Winnie Mandela is portrayed as an alcoholic. She's portrayed as someone who was so angry that she wasn't able to see the grand vision. So maybe you could talk about what were the possibilities. And Sandra, I mean, you're in public relations, but it wasn't easy for the South African people to understand who Winnie Mandela was either, because there were so many forces arrayed against her, because the interest of the West in keeping South Africa locked into the hands of white settlers was clear, right? And Winnie Mandela and Chris Hani and Steve Biko, they were on the other side, but they were dead. And Winnie Mandela, in many ways, was left standing trying to hold that banner.
I want to go back just a little further, Marcia, and that is that people may not remember that the U.S. government basically was an ardent supporter of white supremacy in South Africa, and specifically had a direct link relative to uranium and the nuclear power industry in South Africa. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison, the Ronald Reagan administration had a very strong link and support to the white minority regime in South Africa, and actually Nelson Mandela himself was termed as a terrorist by the U.S. government. So that these sentiments that are deeply entrenched within U.S. diplomatic circles did not just go away, did not just evaporate. So that that tendency to want to, in fact, obviously align with one of the most mineral-rich nations in South Africa, one of the most developed relative to infrastructure, the U.S. government had a stake and had a long-standing stake in really kind of supporting the ability to continue to benefit from the extraction process, et cetera. And throughout the history of the anti-apartheid movement, the U.S. government also tried to cultivate forces within the ANC, whether it was Thabo Mbeki, et cetera, to try to be sympathetic to an apologetic and a negotiated settlement with, as you mentioned, with white business interests, to be able to maintain those links to profit.
Exactly.
So that this is a long-standing process that actually even precedes Winnie Mandela. It's just that Winnie Mandela was standing in the way. She was standing there in the door saying, no, this is not going to happen. The people should not be treated this way. And as a result, she was bombarded by from all sides, both internally and externally, for that role in really trying to advocate for working people and for people who were really experiencing the brunt of the economic divide and chasm between those who are resourced and those who are not within the country.
Thank you. Professor Inyandu, what is your perspective on this?
To understand this, I think I've tried to analyze it using what I call the four tribes during the liberation. In other words, the subgroups that formed the liberation struggle. One, you have the prisoners, mainly in Robben Island and so on and so forth. These people, yes, they spent years of hard labor, but they were with their comrades. Conditions were relatively, as far as prison life is concerned in South Africa, were relatively comfortable, and for lack of a better term, made even better by the comrade of the fellow comrades that are there and so on and so forth. And there's a sort of a rapport, institutionalized rapport. We even see this after they come back from prison. Some of them write books with the warders, with the ex-warders and so on and so forth. Then you have the second tribe, exiles. They come to America, they go to United Kingdom, they live, compared to fellow South Africans, fairly comfortable lives by virtue of being in Western countries. They study, they gain advanced degrees. Then you have the third group, the ones who go further afield in Africa. They live in meager condition, under meager conditions. They don't go to school, many of them, and they're just trying to prepare for the armed struggle. Then the fourth and the largest group, the ones who stay in South Africa, largest by the population of South Africans, the most South Africans stayed in South Africa. Mama Winnie Mandela was governing over this group of people. But as the 1990s beckoned and the merriment of a new South Africa, under this happiness and hysteria that we are going to good times are ahead, Mama Winnie Mandela, there was a movement within the ANC to put her to the back, because she represented and became a de facto leader of the biggest slice of support. In fact, once the exiles come home and the prisoners come back, it's the only playground for power. And Mama Winnie had claimed that. And the movement, in a way, this is where Simon Bolivar, one of the revolutionary leaders in Latin America, said, he who works for the revolution plows the ocean. Because at the end of the day, she's going to face betrayal, thanklessness, and loneliness.
Yes.
And that's an unfortunate chapter of our liberation struggle. But it emanates from the success, let's not undermine the success of the apartheid government and its machinery, to divide these factions and keep them as such. So when power, the spoils of liberation, are now needing to be divided, these tribes will remain so. And some would say, and I'd agree with that, they remain so till this very day.
Yes, yes, Benjamin.
Yeah, I mean, I think just going back and looking really at the ANC, its recent history, the last 10 to 15 years, and even going back to the 1950s, the ANC has a history of expelling those forces that are not towing a line, right? So more recently, you could go back to the 1950s with the Pan-Africanist Congress, mm-hmm. its creation and the need for it to be created. Or even more recently, you have the ANC Youth League, mm-hmm. its elements that had to be purged out because mm-hmm. they wanted to fulfill the demands of the Freedom Charter.
Right.
NUMSA, mm-hmm. other labor, for those forces within the labor federations. So whenever you have this force within the ANC that, hey, let's fulfill at least those minimum demands of the Freedom Charter. I mean, you could have critiques of the Freedom Charter, but there's still that in of itself, just those who want to fulfill that uncompromising position, that sort of left wing within the ANC, it seems there's this pattern across time throughout the decades of consistently purging those elements out, whoever they may be, whether they're in labor, they're in youth league, they're in women's league, wherever they're at, the ANC finds them and will purge them out because they don't toe that line. And I think you see with Winnie Mandela, and even more recently, like I said, with the Youth League and with labor elements within the Labor Federation, the same similar situation.
Would you mind, Benjamin, just give us a two-second elevator speech on what is the Freedom Charter? Because we've used that term a couple of times.
Okay,
now.
Well, the Freedom Charter was in the 1950s, a series of meetings. I think maybe people can go into more depth into it, but it was discussing, the idea was that the land belongs to all, was the general sentiment of it. It was the 1950s, the various forces of the different Africans, coloreds, whites, all came together and said, we're going to create a document that brings together these various movement forces. Out of that grew the Freedom Charter that said the land belongs to all, the resources, education.
Nationalization of mines.
Nationalization, what we would call now nationalization and a mm-hmm. almost democratic, like a social democratic program,
right,
really.
Exactly.
Not even for full socialist, but I'd say a social democratic program. But that program was never put in place.
Right.
And whenever those who come and say we can fulfill those minimum demands, that they're purging from the organization.
Right. And maybe that's where I ended the story, because I was one of the U.S. representatives from the U.S. to South Africa. And unfortunately, I was actually at the negotiating table when I saw the Freedom Charter being thrown under the table. And wrote people back in the United States saying, I've just seen the Freedom Charter discarded by both the South Africans and the United States government. And there were very heroic South Africans on the other side who fought for maintaining the Freedom Charter, but they were overruled by those who were in power at that time.
That was Masha Coleman Adebayo on her radio program, What's at Stake in Washington, D.C.
Prison slavery abolitionists are planning a nationwide prison strike from this coming August 21st to September 9th. The inmates have put forward a list of 10 demands, including an end to work without wages behind the bars. Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with two of the organizers. Brother Akin Yele works with the inmate group Unheard Voices, OTCJ, based in South Carolina, where fighting among inmates at the Lee Correctional Facility left 7 dead and many injured last month. Brother D is a member of Jailhouse Lawyers Speak.
This particular strike was called by a number of prisoners throughout the nation. I'm sure you probably have the document in front of you. And also, these are a lot of guys that was already familiar with previous strikes, September the 9th, all the way down to the last one was August the 19th. After the incident that occurred at Lee Prison in South Carolina, a lot of the prisoners that was very familiar with prison conditions throughout the nation feel the need to stand up and support South Carolina, particularly South Carolina prisoners in their human rights struggle for better conditions, as well as citizen reform inside the state. See, South Carolina is pretty much reflective of the rest of the nation. The only thing is, we want to put a spotlight on the state of South Carolina, because the state of South Carolina's incident is an indictment on the nation as a whole. The only difference is that in this particular incident, you had over 7 casualties behind enemy lines. The national demands that have been drawn up, we've always drawn them up in the context of prison slavery. We understand what prison slavery is. We understand the fundamentals of the prison system. We understand the foundations of it. With that said, it's drawn up in that context, but it was drawn up with this time, was separate from the September the 9th and August the 19th, is that they are drawn up from the perspective also with federal prisoners being involved in the conversation as well this time. So that kind of changes the dynamics of what's actually taking place now.
There are some specific acts and laws which pertain to imprisoned individuals that are being targeted as regards y'all's demands. These are laws that were signed during the Clinton regime, correct?
Correct. You're absolutely correct. These are laws that came into effect, as you said, it was signed in the laws under Bill Clinton. Particularly, you start dealing with things like the Prison Litigation Reform Act or the Truth in Sentencing Act. The Prison Litigation Reform Act, what it did was it strangled prisoners nationwide from having the ability to address grievances within the prison systems. Whether you're state or federal, it strangled our hold. It did strangle our hold on that angle. It also strangled our hold on having access to the courts, not through just civil litigation, but also through criminal litigation as it relates to addressing our convictions. Once upon a time, when new evidence arrived or any evidence arrived, you was able to immediately address it in the court system. But now, it is a deadline. If you don't have it filed within a year, then your entire case is gone. And it goes on and on and on. And what they did was, it was an intentional design to hinder prisoners' access throughout the nations to the courts. So we're looking at these type of things right here. These are things that prisoners throughout the nation feel that has caused or accumulated to the positions that we are in today, or us living in the conditions we're living in today, as well as Truth and Sentencing, which Brother Comrade here brought up with the work he's doing. They're addressing the state of South Carolina and other places throughout the nation, but in the state of South Carolina right now, they're trying to have 85% drop down to 65. I think it's 60. Brother, is it 60, 65%, correct?
65, yeah.
Trying to have that drop down right now. This is a courageous effort, because a lot of other states have also started to reevaluate on this particular policy as well that was forced on states, actually, in order to continue to receive federal funding. And it doesn't just stop there. As you can see, the list of demands, they're across the board. We understand that they impact for living conditions back inside this nation. These particular laws, the way it was designed to dehumanize us as well as to make us feel hopeless.
Absolutely. So, Brother Akeen, would you be willing to expand a bit more on that act in particular, the Truth in Sentencing Act, and how it is affecting y'all inside?
They had on the news down here yesterday that the governor, McMaster, down here gave an executive order, and everybody was waiting in anticipation that hopefully there was something good for the prisoners or something that was going to help the situation back here. But his executive order just basically was dealing with lifting certain standards, I guess, for people they were hiring. So they basically just hiring more employees. Nothing that was said about the situation that's going on back here. Hiring more employees is not going to help the prisoners be rehabilitated and things of that nature. Hard for inmates, like the brother was saying, what they're trying to do is get them to go back a lot to do with the old system that they had prior to a previous director they had by the name of Michael Moore. He came to the prison system, he saw how the prisoners were living at that time, this was like in the mid-90s, and he took a lot of things away, like state pay. You know, a lot of people think that prisoners in South Carolina get paid for labor, but we don't. The only prisoners that do get paid are those who work prison industries, which is a multi-billion dollar industry. In federal prison and state prison, everybody can work prison industry. So every other job on the prison is plumbing, electricians, carpenters, landscapers, cooks, janitors, whatever it may be. We don't get paid for none of that work. We got to work for free. Hospital inmates are also asking for things that they used to give, like credit for good time and good behavior, and just a sense of giving the guy some hope. They had all kind of programs. Now, with these mandatory sentences, the prisoners basically lost all hope. It's like a survival of the fittest type of thing back then. The fact that they took the state pay thing away, it hurts because now the prisoners rob and steal to take care of themselves or to provide for their families. Fathers who still have children on the outside who they attempted to take care of. They had jobs and stuff, but they can actually still work. They can still do that. It's unfair to the mothers out there who raised their children on their own. The living situation back here, it's like a concentration camp, it's like a gulag. The food, some of it is labeled not for human consumption. Some of the cleaning solutions that they give us is institutional use only. It doesn't disinfect, it doesn't sanitize. People are getting MRSA, they get staph diseases. We're housed with people with hepatitis and people with HIV and AIDS and all these kind of things. And when your immune system is not operating properly, it can also lead to vitamin deficiency, making it difficult for you to reproduce upon leaving prison. The grievance system in which we are supposed to grieve our issues too, they actually work for the prison. They're not with the employees here, so that's another biased thing. And one of the issues that in 1971, dealing with the Attica historical uprising, is that they had no way of getting the grievances and stuff out. This is how the grievance system and this is how the inmate representative committee and all these things came into play a long time after that. And South Carolina prison system does not recognize these things. They treat this prison system just like you're still in slavery. They just want you to work and lay down, work and lay down, work and lay down. That's all they want you to do and do nothing else. Nothing else productive is going on. They said on the news yesterday, well, all the things that was placed in the Senate House for the last year, six bills was on the table dealing with parole, dealing with sentencing reform, even the bill for the House of Inmates, the H-5155. They haven't even looked at it yet. So anything that has been placed on the governor's desk or anything of that nature in regards to bettering the prison system itself, as well as resolutions to warehousing of prisoners, they totally neglected to even acknowledge these things. All they're talking about is getting money from these people to hire more employees. Hire more employees, hire more employees. That's not a resolution to the problem back here. These guys have lost all hope. They feel like if we've been sentenced here to die, then they just don't care no more.
You are also demanding that Pell Grants be reinstated. What justification could these prison slavers possibly offer as to why Pell Grants inside of prisons should not exist?
Absolutely, absolutely. For me, there's no justification for it. When they took it from us, it was definitely a part of a dehumanization process. A lot of people during that time period was complaining because prisoners was actually being educated. Prisoners was coming home more educated. Prisoners had more opportunities to get jobs. This is a dumb down of the prison population, and this is what they're sending back out into society. So this is not helping society. Prisoners are making things worse.
Absolutely. And just to add on to that just a little bit, just to give it a little visual, even when people commit crimes, whether they're guilty or not, when they come into this prison system right here in South Carolina, as I said before, they want you to work. Just like in slavery time, you get up, you work all day long, you go back to your slave quarters and sleep the next day, whatever. That's exactly how they run things in South Carolina. This is the everyday thing. Slaves weren't allowed to learn and stuff like that. The educational system, they got one little small little building, and supposedly for people to get their GEDs, it's always backed up. They got a list for so long. The GED whole program they got is behind. They don't have no computers and stuff. Technology and society is advancing, but the prisoners are not advancing. Because you got guys that have been back here 30 years who thinking that they still go in society and get a piece of paper to fill out their application. Society is way past that. Everything is almost on computers now. They're not having us advance at all. It's like they just want to keep us in a zombie state. There's nothing for the guys to do but stand around and just indulge in negative activities. And as I said before, the money part is important because guys will result to robbing, stealing, and hurting each other to get to provide for themselves, because the food that they serve us, the quality of it and the quantity of it is nowhere near for a grown man. They feed us like we're children to keep us small, to keep us weak, so that we can't really fight back in no kind of way, whether mentally, physically, or spiritually. Every door that's open that has anything to do with resolutions, they close it, they close it, they close it. They say they don't have no money in South Carolina, but presently, right now, in South Carolina, on Broad River Road, they are building a new prison. Right now. It's almost complete.
What would be the best way that those on the outside can go about supporting these actions beginning in August?
I like to close out with August the 21st. We have a number of different states right now that are involved making this call. And we're asking people, first of all, if you want to know how to get involved or know who to contact, you can reach at mediansforprisoners@gmail.com. We can direct you to any local organization that may be organizing on the ground. If you're trying to reach out to us, media contacts, reach us at prisonstrikemedia@gmail.com. As far as generally what they can do, they can support any local prisoner organizers on the outside, as well as contact prisoners inside, notify prisoners. We can't reach all prisoners. Notify prisoners of the national strike that's going down in their state, and not only in the prisons, but in the county jails, immigration detention centers, as well as the federal pens as well. We're asking people to download the PDF copy of the national strike demands, circulate it. We're asking people to drop banners, to hold rallies, whether you're holding rallies at the local prisons, the local courthouses, the local jails. We want you to hold rallies. Support the call on August the 21st. Get the word out as much as you possibly can.
Just to add on to that, as well as on August 21st, we are asking that our loved ones go out to their state houses, wherever city or state they may be in, and rally there. We are trying to pool buses and things and raise money for it in South Carolina so that we can have our loved ones on the outside rally for us in front of these state houses the same day that we lay down in prison to show some unification with us. Sometimes family members come to prison and they visit their loved ones, but the prisoner might don't talk about the things going on back here. They might just want to spend that time with their family and not stress them out or worry them about the situation back here. But we need loved ones to start asking their family members, what's going on back there? How you living back there? Man, give me the truth so I can know what's going on.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.